begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Isaac. One good example in class action, with some results, begats another one. By 1944, wildcat strikes were beginning to develop throughout basic industry. Following the example the miners had set, on the one side aiming their fire against the wage freeze, trying to take advantage of the gap the miners had rammed into the wage freeze wall, and parallel with it, there was a pronounced rise in the appearance of sentiment for and resolutions in favor of and calling for the development of a labor party in 44. The war is still on. Now, there was a third interesting thing that happened in 44. We're in prison now. We went into prison. We celebrated New Year's Eve between 1943 and 1944 by going to prison. We're in prison at this time. And among other things in the fight, we've made a demand that Roosevelt pardons. A defense committee has been organized, and a campaign is on to get petitions signed by individuals and resolutions adopted by unions calling on Roosevelt to give us a pardon. He didn't do it, but what happened is interesting. Interesting in a double sense. We got support in the form of resolutions adopted by unions representing hundreds of thousands of members in the year 1944, while the war is still on, calling upon Roosevelt to pardon us. Here you are in conditions of war. We're in prison on the charge of advocating the overthrow of the government by force and violence, and hundreds of thousands of workers through the mechanisms of their unions in basic industry are voting for resolutions calling on the president to pardon us and let us out of prison, because class struggle is coming back in the air. Now, the second point I want to make there is just note. Suppose we had gone to prison to serve our 16 months immediately after the trial. And suppose we had been in jail in 1942 instead of 1944. We would still have made the pardon demand as part of the political fight against the capitalist government for jailing us for our socialist ideas. But we wouldn't have begun to get the kind of solidarity in our pardon petition in 1942 that we were to receive in 1944, because objective conditions were beginning to change. Now, with the end of the war, there was an unprecedented strike wave developed, and absolutely unprecedented in its scope, in its magnitude. But before I speak briefly about that strike wave, I want to touch on another thing that happened that, in the last analysis, was intimately related with the new upsurge of labor. In no time at all after VJ Day, demonstrations began throughout all the theaters of war across the world by the American troops demanding they be demobilized and brought home. Their thinking as expressed can be boiled down to this. All right, we agreed we had to fight this war against fascism. You didn't give us too good a shuffle while we were gone. Now the war is won. The purpose of this army and the purpose of our being in it no longer exists. Bring us home. This was the mood of the troops. It was echoed by the families of the troops within the country. And as happens in periods of struggle, always somebody, you know, with an eye to put things short, sharp, and to the point, comes up with a slogan that catches on. And in no time at all, after the first troop demonstrations began, a slogan emerged in the kind of language that all politicians understand, no boats, no votes. Put us on those transports and take us back, or don't expect to get reelected, buddy boy. That's what they were telling these capitalist politicians. Now, the demonstrators within the armed forces that were demanding that they be brought home and demobilized were principally and primarily the workers in the ranks of the army, and the organizers of the demonstrations were principally and primarily men who had been job stewards, picket captains, local union officers in the preceding days of the battles that gave rise to the CIO. As a case of putting union know-how to work to a good class purpose under changed conditions. It's kind of like, you remember I told you the slogan that we used to try to inculcate into these young over-the-road truck drivers coming off the trucks and becoming union negotiators. They'd ask, can we do this, can we do that? We keep repeating to them, you can do anything you're big enough to do. At least these workers who had been the rank and file leaders, at least in the lesser positions in the rise of the CIO, they had learned in their experiences in industry this notion, whether or not put that way, you can do anything you're big enough to do. And they weren't as overawed as, for instance, a 30-year career man in the Army would be with the seeming power of the general staff. Now, let me note one more thing about the troop demonstrations before we come back to the strike wave. Not only was the United Mine Workers strike of 1943 an unprecedented class struggle action in the history of the United States of America, the troop demonstrations after VJ Day were unprecedented in the whole history of the human race. Why? I challenge you to go back through the pages of history and find a single case where a victorious conquering army faced mutiny in its ranks the day after victory. And that's what the troop demonstrations were. It was mutiny, if you please. And don't you think there weren't a lot of brass hats around in the fall of 1945 and spring of 1946 that wouldn't have liked to have put the firing squads to work against these non-coms and PFCs and others in the ranks of the armed forces that had this background unit experience that were organizing these demonstrations. And it's a demonstration on the one side here again of the power of the working class, and a demonstration also of the capacity of the working class to assert itself, to be ingenious about it, to be inventive, to be creative, to be bold, and to be determined. When they reach the decision, the time has come to act. And that also is the history of the working class. Don't ever make a sweeping judgment of what is fundamental to the working class on the basis of what you perceive of it at a given moment. Judge the working class. Don't judge. It's a little presumptive to judge a whole class within society. I use the wrong word. Study. Try to understand the working class is a better way to put it, on the basis of the totality of the historic record, and see the motion of things. In your own life, you know, you get in a pretty rough way if you don't get a certain number of hours of sleep, and in 24. Now, see, your problem with respect to a class in evaluating it is that the motion of social forces in class terms are utterly indifferent to that all-important question of the individual, of the length of his life and what is going on at the moment. Meaning, no offense, let's take an insect. I'm not gifted enough in science to be able to name a specific one, but I have heard, it wasn't told to me, but I've heard, that there are some insects that are born, mature, and die within 2 or 3 hours. See what I'm getting at? If you evaluate social forces on the basis of what happens just within whatever the gamut of your lifespan has been up to this moment, or out of impatience because it isn't doing what you think it ought to do if that's what it's historically capable of doing while you want it done, you kind of get in the position of this insect that was born, matured, grew old and died, we'll say between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. So he goes to wherever insects go when they die, and somebody says, what about the human race? And he says, the bastards sleep all the time. You see what I mean? Now, the workers demonstrated a tremendous power. The strike battles opened in the main with a strike of the General Motors workers that began within the month after VJ Day. If memory serves me right, it was underway before the end of September. VJ Day was toward the latter part of August, 1945. Became quite a battle. And the significant thing here is not what happened in the GM strike itself, although it was one of the focal battles. The significant thing is that following GM, paralleling it, came strikes of steel workers, strikes of coal miners, strikes of electrical workers, strikes of rubber workers, strikes of truck drivers, strikes of food workers. And in basic industry alone, at the crest of the 1945-46 strike wave, over 2 million workers were on the picket lines at one time, along toward the crest of the wave. Am I right, Hank? It was along about January, February of 46, wasn't it? It reached the crest. Some 2 million workers were on the picket line at one time. And what a power! What a power! Now, the bosses didn't even make an attempt to try to break any picket lines. You know, the only real skirmishes, if you can call it a skirmish, that took place in the strikes was that here and there, you know, some high echelon of management thinks he ought to go into the plant and see if there's a faucet leaking someplace or whatever high echelons of management do when they go into a struck plant. And the workers just, out of pure contrariness maybe, or because they had nothing else to do, or they wanted to say that when they mean tight, they mean tight, they'd say you ain't going in. Oh, the cops would come down and they'd try to make a show, you know, management, you got to let him in. Maybe the workers say no. Cops try to shove him in. Sometimes the workers would slap the cops back. You know. It wasn't a big thing, but it was really the only kind of struggles there were. Wasn't any problem at all of running Finks in. And the biggest disappointment the bosses got from the point of view of the question of Finks was the men out of the armed forces. Throughout the whole war, they had these orientation courses. Well, they're about like you run into the plants, you know, and they call you to a safety meeting. You know, the whole object of the thing is here, we don't want you killing one another, you know, unnecessarily. Which means don't kill one another unless it's necessary in order to get out the necessary production the boss wants on a certain day. Call a safety meeting. You get a little talk about safety, and you get a little infusion of company propaganda and one thing and another. Throughout the war, the so-called political orientation courses in the armed forces were shot through with anti-labor lectures. And maybe you think the ruling class didn't go to town on the United Mine Workers when they struck in 1943. They were doing their best to try to convince the rank and file of the armed forces that this proves to the hilt unions are no good. Look here, they would say, you're here fighting and dying in these trenches, in these foxholes, in these submarines, these battleships, these bombers. And these guys who have got it soft, all they got to do is dig a little coal. They're striking for more pay. That's what unions are. You can just imagine, you know, what a good demagogue can do with a situation like that. It adds a little touch of delicacy to the refined, striking, breaking role of the Communist Party, that they were saying the same thing in the Daily Worker that the brass hats were saying in the orientation courses, the troops in the army, about the miners' strike. But with all this indoctrination, and it comes as no surprise, certainly, after I've described to you briefly the nature and circumstances of the demonstrations demanding the demobilization after the war, the veterans of World War II didn't come out of the army anti-union in the droves. They came out of the army and onto the picket lines of the 1945-46 strike wave. And they were some of the ones that were rather eager and impetuous about slapping the cops around, because they'd just gotten quite a college education in the art of slapping people around, with the government picking up the tab all the time they were in the army. You had a tremendous solidarity of the class. All that was lacking was leadership. The solidarity was so great that the middle class, the same middle class, same generic social force that from whose ranks today you hear so many pundits chattering about how labor can't lead social advance, the middle class has to, same middle class was just caught in the vortex of this labor struggle like people are sucked into the wake of an avalanche in the Alps. Harold Ickes, the curmudgeon, Secretary of the Interior of the Roosevelt administration for a long time, a big wheeler dealer in top circles of government, accepted the chairmanship of a committee of middle-class intellectuals to raise money to help support the General Motors workers, whom the General Motors Corporation was trying to starve out. They were on strike the longest of any of them. The corporation was trying to starve them out and down. Just that one single example indicates the impact on the middle class. I remember well a plaintive editorial in the New York Times. They're very balanced, you know, very objective, see all sides of every question as long as it's the boss's side. And they were deploring the breakdown of the great American norms by the emergence of what they said, this modern concept that it's a crime to cross a picket line. This permeated society under the impact of the great labor struggle to the point that this was the effect in all sides. Now, in these circumstances, it had become crystal clear to thinking people then, including many, many thinking people in the union movement, that were not revolutionists, as symbolized by the fact, for instance, as I observed, that beginning with 1944, more and more local unions, and occasionally here even a token gesture from an international union developed, particularly within the CIO, calling for the formation of a labor party. It was clear that pure and simple unionism had reached a definitive dead end, and that it was necessary for labor to break with the capitalist two-party system and take the road of independent class political action. But it happened. The bureaucrats were able to block the way to an independent labor party, and the upsurge of 1943-46 again stopped at the union level and didn't break through the political barrier of the capitalist two-party system and take the class political level in the name of labor. The result was that the upsurge gave way to the Cold War and the witch hunt, which I don't think I have to describe to you, because we now have arrived on this fourth night at this point at that climate in the United States with which you are reasonably familiar, because that is the climate that has existed throughout the whole conscious life of the young people present in this gathering tonight. There's been 18 years of bureaucratic bankruptcy in the union movement. And as I've tried in every way I could think of, on the basis of demonstrated facts of the struggle history of the working class across the years we've discussed in these four talks, to demonstrate, it is not a crisis of the capacity of the workers to struggle. It is a crisis of union leadership. Now today, superficially, the relationships between capital and labor appear relatively stable. But as I remarked in a previous session, that apathy is a relative thing, and change can be taking place without your being able to perceive it at the moment. Even where you see a relative stability in class relations, a relative equilibrium between labor and capital, that's not the whole of the picture. There are internal alterations occurring that are generating instability at the very moment you think you see essential stability. Just let me mention three of these. One, the economic attrition that finds its expression in the growing problem of chronic unemployment, its persistence, its rise, the growing economic security felt by people who have still got employment. That is that whole circumstance whereby modern technology is being applied in industry to advance the good and welfare of the profit picture of the boss at the increasing expense of the working class as a whole. That's one. Another, the threat of nuclear war. The Korean War, the record I think shows, is the most unpopular war up to the present situation that the United States ever fought. Now, the war in Vietnam has not yet reached the scope and intensity that the Korean War reached, although the gang in Washington is working overtime to push it in that direction if they can. What you saw in the reaction to the Korean War, I mentioned the coal miners in 43, one of the things that typified the Korean War was that many unions, following the old maxim, go thou and do likewise, proceeded throughout the Korean War to go on strike when they weren't satisfied with the outcome of a negotiation, like the miners had gone on strike in 1943. Their criteria was not that Truman said it's a national emergency and everybody's got to sacrifice so we can kill more Koreans and Chinese. Their criteria was, all right, what's the powers that be in this country done for us lately? In the Korean War, even the railway switchmen went on strike, in case you didn't know it. And the railway switchmen are not exactly one of the most militant bodies of workers in the United States of America. This growing apprehension with the realization that these madmen in Washington are toe-dancing three-quarters drunk along the precipice of a nuclear holocaust. And people know there's no place to hide. Why the tension during those terrible hours there for a few days in the Cuban crisis of 1962, when those Soviet ships were heading for Cuba? Kennedy had ordered the fleet out there to stop them. Everybody knew the United States has got nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union has got nuclear weapons. Will or won't the Soviet ships stop? Will or won't the American forces open fire on them? Will it or will it not lead to a nuclear war? Will I be alive this day next week? That was deep in the minds of a lot of people. Now, there's another aspect of this that's important to keep in mind. I'm talking now about these forces that are operating underneath the surface that generate instability in circumstances where visually appears there is stability. Now, we're sitting here, there's a lot of street noise going on out here. Or you can be in any kind of a situation where there's a lot of noise. And we have a catchphrase, a fanciful notion that we become accustomed to those things, don't we? But medical science tells you it's not so. You've been affected more than you realize you have. You're just not aware of it. And it may not ever be known because the result might not be such as to cause you any particular trouble. Science tells you that about this. That's the same, in that same essential sense that I'm speaking about this fundamental aspect of the threat of nuclear war, the effect it's having on people. Now, I've mentioned on several occasions concerning radicalization that when people are holding their own or feel they got a chance of getting some reform, a few concessions in due course, they tend not to radicalize and not to struggle. It applies for the ruling, for the working class. It applies in all forms of social struggle. But there's another factor that comes to bear here. It does not necessarily take a catastrophic blow to break the stability and precipitate mass action. The constant attrition of these processes that generate a sense of fear, a sense of insecurity, a sense of instability can trigger an explosion. It does not necessarily take a shock of the depth of the depression in the 30s to precipitate another labor upsurge. And finally, there's the effect, the impact on the working class of the dehumanizing trends that are being imposed upon the people of this country under this outlived capitalist system that long ago passed beyond that brief moment in history where it played a temporarily progressive role in helping to take organized society out of the feudal system onto a higher capacity to produce and advance technology. Long ago has passed beyond that, is outlived and is rotten ripe to be tossed into the dustbin of history and replaced by a new, higher, emancipating socialist form of society. But in trying to cling to its special privilege and its rule, the capitalist class is more and more dehumanizing people. And this has its repercussions in many ways that introduce instability. Maybe I can sum it up by just quoting briefly a passage from one of O'Hara's books that he writes, the novels he writes about the middle class in eastern Pennsylvania. That, in my mind, in its own way, just kind of epitomizes the norms of human relations that capitalism as a whole is trying to impose upon people. This is a Saturday night party of a gathering of middle-class men and women that are doctors, dentists, merchants, one thing and another, in this little eastern Pennsylvania town. And they get together, and as is the custom, husbands and wives don't sit next to one another. They're mixed up so that men who are sitting next to women are not their wives, and women are sitting next to men that are not their husbands. And this little vignette is inserted by O'Hare at this point. Lady says to the man on her right at the table, "Are you one of my husband's customers?" He said, "No." She said, "Then get your hand off my leg." I think it just epitomizes the norms that capitalism is setting for society as a whole. Meaningful capitalist concessions to the working class are no longer in the cards in any way, shape, or form. Instead, there's an intensification of labor exploitation, and along with it, a three-pronged boss offensive against the union movement that is running deeper all the time. On the job, the rat race of the speed-up, the return more and more to the old tyranny of the open shop days before the CIO is becoming increasingly the norm in basic industry. All that's different is that the union bureaucrats are performing some of the functions that the sub-foreman used to perform of ratting on and backing the bosses up and disciplining the workers that don't cut the buck by the boss's criteria. When a contract expires and the union comes in with demands for a renewal of contract, the bosses are there with counter-demands to take away something. And more are government controls being imposed on the unions. Not only the Taft-Hartley law, not only the Landrum-Griffin law, but in the generalized form of the terror the government is sowing among the bureaucrats by the arrogant way in which they're slapping out at a union like the Teamsters in the form of this vendetta against Hoffa, who is not the sine qua non of a union leader. But that's beside the point. Hoffa's shortcomings, his weaknesses, the question of whether or not he should be head of the Teamsters Union is a thing to be decided by the Teamsters Union. And in the name of trying to protect workers from crooks, isn't that an irony? The government of the biggest gang of crooks in this country, the bosses, in the name of trying to protect the workers from the crooks, got this vendetta going against Hoffa, and the object is the Teamsters Union. And by these terror campaigns in which the bureaucrats fall all over one another in reputing, condemning, and goddamning whatever official or whatever union comes under attack, even without passing a law, they're imposing more and more the iron hand of government control on the workers. And all this is just preamble to codifying the thing in laws that'll be even more heinous than the Taft-Hartley Act and the Landrum-Griffin Law. From another point of view, every time there's a partial union struggle, every time there's a partial union action, it has the force and effect of posing to thinking people the fact that larger issues are involved and that nothing can be settled except on a larger scale. And in this situation, the union movement, the working class, is going to be impelled toward a new upsurge of struggle, The unions are going to be pushed in the direction of the formation of an independent labor party, breaking with the capitalist two-party system. The need for a change in leadership is going to become plainer and plainer to the rank and file of the workers. Rifts of new kinds will be precipitated in the bureaucracy, in the general nature of those I described to you that were utilized in the struggles in Minneapolis in breaking in to get a class battle going. And it will open new possibilities for militants to step forward in the union movement as they did in the 30s. From another point of view, there's a two-sided aspect of the Negro struggle that should be kept carefully in mind in this regard. One side of it is the bureaucratic crime of helping the white supremacists split the labor movement. I could mention many categories, but I'll mention just one. What a crime it is not to have made the kind of a fight that would go in the direction of removing the fear of unemployment by using the power of labor to see that labor gets benefit instead of unemployment out of technological progress. What a crime that instead they really think on the Negro struggle by saying to workers who are concerned that equality of employment will mean putting Negroes into white workers' jobs, and on that narrow axis of personal concern are susceptible to white supremacist propaganda. When I say susceptible to white supremacist propaganda, I don't mean they become prejudiced. The average white worker has prejudice against Negroes. Everybody knows that. It flows from the whole history of the land and the relations of people within the land. But the crime is in the fact that the union bureaucrats, and I mean starting with the very top echelons, are neither counteracting the white supremacist propaganda nor leading the kind of a fight that would both overcome the fears of the white workers and meet the just demands of the Negro workers. In short, serve the interests of the working class as a whole at the expense of the boss class, which is where the payment ought to come from. The hypocrisy of the union bureaucracy in their failure to really support the Freedom Now struggle as a whole on all fronts is another factor that touches on the problem of the working class today. Now looked at in the second aspect. Parallel with these difficulties for the civil rights struggle because of the traitorous policies of the union bureaucrats is the impact of the Negro struggle on the union movement. Now, you know, Negro workers today, when I say Negro workers, let me just say parenthetically that I don't speak in the sense that only Negro workers are involved in the civil rights struggle. I don't say that middle class elements among the Negro people are not in their own way militant and becoming more militant in this battle. I use this expression in the sense of recognition that predominantly and their overwhelming majority, the Negro people as a whole, are of the working class. It's in that large sense that I'm now using the expression Negro workers, as well as particularly with regard to the presence of a Negro worker per se in a union. The Negro workers are of the same category as the workers that I described to you in 1934 that formed the battle detachments of the truck drivers that whipped the cops down in the market. And what is that? They're people that have got little or nothing to lose. And Sometimes, you know, that can make quite a battler. That's one factor that's going to impinge in more and more ways in the movement. Moreover, the Negro worker, in addition to being a part of the general fight in this society as a whole for full social, economic, and political equality for minority peoples in all spheres of society, is making a fight for his rights on the job and within the union. And this will have its effects. As a matter of fact, it is becoming more and more the case, and it will be noted by more and more workers, I think, in time, militants among the white workers, that in many respects the Negro movement is already fighting the battle of the white workers for economic security and, yes, if you please, for union democracy. And from another point of view, the mass action that is developing within the civil rights struggle is a highly contagious thing that is going to more and more find its reflexes in the union movement as a whole. And in this overall situation in which more and more instability is being generated within this surface appearance of stability in class relations between the workers and the bosses, the struggle of the Negro people will tend to serve as a catalyst to precipitate a new labor upsurge. And in doing so, it'll drive new and deeper fissures into the Labor Democratic Coalition and push the labor movement in the direction of the formation of an independent labor party. Now here, the labor movement is not as atomized today as it was in the 30s. It isn't necessary for the working class first to gather itself together at the first elementary form of organization, the union, as was required in the 1930s. The workers are not wholly organized. There's a lot of workers that could and should be in the unions that are not now in them. But there is ample organized union power at hand right here and now to become the tremendous central dynamo for projecting the working class and all the allies of the working class onto the political arena in its own name with its own party. And the basis is there then for a swift leap, once the process starts, beyond the framework of capitalist two-party politics to the formation of an independent labor party. Now, militants, revolutionary militants today are not in a position to summon the workers to this battle, saying to them, this is what is necessary and this is what you must do, now let's come and act. Much less to say in a position to try in any way, shape, or form to substitute some other force for it. Not yet in a position to challenge the bureaucrats for union leadership. The relation of forces as yet is a little too strongly against the militants. And we can't predict yet when the upsurge is coming. But come it will, that we can be certain. And the central theme of everything I have tried to communicate to you in these four talks, in terms of a piece of the actual struggle history of the working class, is to communicate that realization that not everything that you see is exactly what appears to meet the eye. Something is changing. Younger people who have never had a chance to see this class in motion will find in coming times that there's something there you couldn't have dreamed were present, and that once it starts to move, you are going to be not only an eyewitness to, but a part of what is going to be one of the most tremendous chapters that has ever been written in the history of the human race. There are two titanic powers in this world today. that are central to the final showdown as to whether society on this planet is going to be driven back to barbarism under the rule of capitalism, madmen with the nuclear bombs, or whether it's going to go forward to a socialist society. One of those powers at the center of the determining point is the ruling class of the United States of America. It is a power not because that power is inherent in the ruling class in the sense it's able to throw it around today. The ruling class is a power because it is able yet to manipulate the greater power, the power of the American working class, to its advantage. And until that brute force, the ruling class of the United States, as represented by its minions of the Republican and Democratic Party in Washington, are removed from power and replaced by the working class power, this world is going to face the danger of a nuclear holocaust, and the qualitative breakthrough of mankind to a world socialist society is going to be prevented. Therefore, in the last analysis, because of this fact, the ultimate fate of the human race is going to be definitively settled right here in the United States of America in a clash between the capitalist ruling class and the working class. And those of you here who are 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, I envy you. I envy you, because unless you get run over with a 10-ton truck, you've got a very good chance of being a witness of and a participant in what is going to prove to be one of the greatest, the most triumphant chapters in the history of the whole human race. And meantime, in everything that you do in trying to build toward the realization of the socialist cause, for all the reasons I have tried to state in these four talks, seek always in your thinking and in your action to point the way toward labor to power in the United States of America. Let that be the pole star by which you navigate.
Seems very appropriate after this tremendous series of four lectures that we've heard on the labor movement to announce a new book. It's called Labor's Giant Step. It's written by Art Price. Art Price is a veteran of the trade union movement. He has been a writer for the militants since 1940. His book, Labor's Giant Step, which is a 20-year history of the CIO, is coming out in publication this October. And from now until September 15th, we can offer a special pre-publication price. After the book comes out in October, it's going to be selling for $7.50. But until that time, we can offer this book for $5. I think it's a tremendous addition to the whole literature on the labor movement. John is collecting money. He's sitting right over here. Would you stand up just a second so everybody can see him? If you want to order the book today or sometime in the very near future, talk to him tonight or tell him how you'll give him the money. This is a very significant book. Secondly, there's going to be a party here tonight right after the question and answer period, and you are all invited to stay. Now we're going to have about a 5 to 10 minute intermission, and then the floor will be open to questions from the floor.
coming election. It would be wise for the, if Commissioner Knobbach doesn't think it would be wise for the socialist party to concentrate their abilities on beating the Goldwater ticket rather than dividing the vote. And it would be wiser to support the lesser of two evils, I think.
Could you turn that off for a moment? I'm just ringing. Hope you won't mind it interferes here. Let me suggest first two items that it would be worthwhile for you to read on this subject. One is the election platform of the Socialist Workers' Party in this presidential election. And there you will find a presentation of our thinking of how fatal it is for the labor movement, the civil rights movement, for students who want to see a change to a better society, to continue in the concept of the lesser evil theory that has been used to date in the United States to keep the working people and their allies entrapped in the capitalist two-party system. Second, I forget the exact date, but it's a recent issue of the newspaper, The Militant, contains a statement by DeBerry and Shaw, the presidential ticket of the Socialist Workers' Party, that was issued shortly after Goldwater's nomination. The headline over the statement is How to Fight Goldwaterism, and it returns to this question of lesser evil politics that is dealt with more basically, broadly, and generally in the election platform in specific terms of the significance of the Goldwater nomination. The problem involved, as we see it, and as we seek in every way we can to explain in terms of the social problems of the day, the problem is to pass beyond the capitalist system, that none of the real have to be dealt with quite extensively to go into all the factors. Let me put it this way, that since it is necessary, we contend, to change the system before any of the serious problems can be solved, that is, before economic security can be assured, before there can be real and lasting peace, before there can be full, complete, unconditional equality in all respects for all people, regardless of race, sex, color, and before humanity in its totality can bring its form of social organization into gear with the with the needs required to utilize the great and growing productive capacity of man through his technological advancement to the benefit of all, the present system has to be changed, because this system is predicated on the concept that the means of production that operate for, that are supposed to operate for the benefit of people as a whole, are geared to function in order to make a private profit, a special personal gain, and therefore a special privilege for the owner of those means of production. And that throws everything out of gear. Now,
The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are each capitalist parties. And in saying that, I am only stating a fact that they not only do not try to deny, but that they themselves boast about. You cannot conceive of the possibility of changing the social system. You cannot conceive of the possibility of correcting the many wrongs that exist in society today by supporting a political party that is dedicated to the preservation of the system. So, if at one juncture one feels that on one or another point one of the two parties is a little less bad than the other, which is the essence of the lesser evils theory, that is sort of like saying, well, since I'm going to get the business anyway, I would rather that I get the business by a slower form of torture than to have somebody take a double-bitted meat axe to me. That's what you're saying. And nothing can be solved. Now, from another point of view, what are the differences between the two parties by which you would measure the lesser evil? And as you look at the fundamental issues facing society today, you find that the differences are more and more narrowing down in a rather obvious way to the fact that what's all important is that to the Republicans it's all important they have the offices, and to the Democrats it's all important they have the offices, because to the victor goes the spoils, to those who hold the office goes the pork barrel which can be distributed to the faithful. On foreign policy, they're absolutely, totally, and completely bipartisan. Look at the intervention in Vietnam. They passed from Eisenhower to Kennedy without ever missing a stroke in the military intervention in Vietnam. Just to take a single point. Or take Cuba. The same identical thing happened. The Bay of Pigs invasion was prepared under Eisenhower and executed under Kennedy. And so on, all up and down the line. In foreign policy, there is no line of distinction. I could go on down the other basic policy questions. I just cite this single one. You can take civil rights, labor, economic security. And true, you'll find here and there a politician, maybe in the Republican Party, who will talk a little more about maybe doing a few things, and you'll find here a politician in one or the other party who will be a little blunter, a little tougher about what ought to be done to kick people around who object to the way things are going. But here again, there are two things about it. Both these appear within each of the parties, and in neither case does it represent any qualitative difference. And moreover, even where within either party, be it the Democratic or Republican, you find a politician that will promise more during the election than another one will, they don't deliver after the election is over. Take a political structure of that kind. Then take the historic fact that since the days of the New Deal, there hasn't been one single major social concession made to the working class of this country. Keep in mind that even those concessions were made only in the face of the sweep and power of the radicalization of the working class that gave rise to the CIO. Taken in consideration, Roosevelt, who is now touted as in history since his death as the great emancipating liberal who opened the way to prove this is a classless society and get ahead. When he was nominated in 1932, the convention was held here in Chicago.
We've talked here in these sessions. It comes home to me. There's been a lot of things happening in this town that touch on history. We started with the Haymarket Martyrs, and now we're down to the nomination of Roosevelt in 32. You go back and read Roosevelt's acceptance speech, and while he didn't put it in so many words, you'll find this very astute capitalist politician was saying, in effect, to the bosses, you either make some concessions to the workers or you run the risk of having them turn revolutionary, begin to listen to the radicals, and take away everything you've got. That's why there were some concessions. And on the grounds that, well, things would be a little worse than they are if we didn't get the capitalist politician into office, who at least doesn't talk quite as tough as another, although he doesn't do a whole lot, labor has been trapped all these years in capitalist politics, with the result that the union power is vitiated. And no matter how the workers battle through their union and on a picket line, and no matter what they win through their union and on a picket line, the bosses, through their agents that control the government, can manipulate the government, the operation of the economy, the financial structure, the whole operation of the system as a whole, to reach right into their pocket and take it away from them. Well, just briefly and along those lines, those are some of the fundamental and essential reasons why we think it is fatal to the solution of the increasingly burning problems of the day, and fatal to the future of the human race, for the labor movement to remain tied to capitalist politics on the basis of the lesser evil theory.
The two pieces of literature that Farrell mentioned are available in the hall. The Socialist Workers' Party election platform is right over here on this table, just above the yellow placard and below the bulletin board. Also, the militant that he referred to of about 2 weeks ago is available on this table, as well as the recent issue of the militant back on the large desk. Are there other questions? Yes.
Do you feel that in the next period of upsurge, the workers will be led by some present-day political formation, or do you feel there will be some new rational political formation will take the lead in the struggle?
I wouldn't state categorically what the nature of the formation will be. Let me first state basically what the position of our party is. The Socialist Workers' Party considers itself a party. It tries to shape a program for and win forces for the purpose of helping to mobilize and lead the working class in a struggle to overturn capitalism and establish a socialist society. We do not insist that it has to be the Socialist Workers' Party as it is presently constituted. It will be the party of that revolutionary struggle. What we do insist